House Speaker Nancy Pelosi may visit Taiwan or not, but the very prospect has Beijing and Washington wringing their hands.
There are some question marks here about whether or not the visit could trigger a particularly muscular response from China and perhaps trigger some kind of crisis.
Also today, fishermen in Sri Lanka don't have enough fuel for their vessels. This boat captain said he waited 2.5 months to get diesel. His crew has not been out fishing in a long time. The Federal Reserve hikes up interest rates again to tame domestic inflation, but not without serious ripples across the globe. And the close encounter between a half-ton walrus and a small boat. Walrus 1, boat 0. All that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us today. Will she or won't she? That is the big question in diplomatic circles right now about whether House Speaker Nancy Pelosi will visit Taiwan. Pelosi would become the highest-ranking U.S. politician to travel to the island since 1997. Beijing is warned of serious consequences if Pelosi goes ahead with her visit. Mike Chinoy is a non-resident senior fellow at the U.S.-China Institute. He's currently in Taipei, the capital of Taiwan. First of all, Mike, what is the chatter there about Nancy Pelosi's possible visit?
People here are welcoming of the prospect of Pelosi coming. Taiwan is so isolated internationally that any time a prominent figure from the United States comes to show support, it's generally welcome. But I do think, particularly among people who follow the situation closely, that there are some question marks here about whether or not the visit could trigger a particularly muscular response from China and perhaps trigger some kind of crisis. So this is sort of a mixed reaction, I would say.
Can you remind us why Nancy Pelosi wants to visit Taiwan in the first place?
Pelosi has a long track record of being highly critical of the Chinese Communist authorities going back to the aftermath of the crackdown on democracy demonstrators in Tiananmen Square in 1989. But what makes this trip sort of perplexing is the way in which the word that it might happen came out. It wasn't officially announced by Pelosi. It came out in leaks. President Biden indicated some degree of unease with the prospect of her going. So you have this impression that the Speaker of the House and the President and the top brass in the U.S. military are not altogether in sync about why she's coming now. And there is some concern for sure in Washington that the Chinese could react in such a way as to precipitate a crisis here.
Meantime, President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping are scheduled to talk by phone tomorrow. What's expected to come up in that conversation?
This is one of a series of regular conversations that the two men have had. They know each other going back to before Biden became president, and it's certainly good that the channel exists. But there are major, profound differences on a lot of issues, and Taiwan is really central to that. So it's hard to see what Biden could say to Xi Jinping that would assuage Chinese anger over the prospect of Pelosi coming. And more broadly, what Beijing sees as a kind of incremental chipping away at what it wants to see from the United States, which is kind of hands-off backing Taiwan. But instead, President Biden has said several times publicly that if China attacked Taiwan, the U.S. would come to Taiwan's aid. So Taiwan is kind of moving to front and center as a sore point in the relationship. And from Xi Jinping's point of view, he's about to be anointed for a record third term in office as China's leader and has kind of made clear that he sees his place in history depending partly on being the Chinese leader who took Taiwan back. So there's not a lot of room for give on this issue on either side, I don't think.
I mean, China is warning of serious consequences, they say, if Pelosi visits Taiwan. What do you think that means?
The Chinese have always had this kind of fire-breathing rhetoric when it comes to Taiwan. But in recent months, Chinese military aircraft have been probing into Taiwan's air defense identification zone more aggressively than before. It's hard to know what they might do. There's some speculation they might send up jets to physically prevent Pelosi's U.S. military aircraft from landing, although that seems far-fetched. But in 1995 and 96, when there were tensions over Taiwan, China fired missiles that overflew Taiwan and landed in the Pacific, and President Bill Clinton deployed aircraft carriers to the region. And China now is much more nationalistic, much more assertive internationally, and its overall relationship with the United States and with Taiwan is much more tense. So we don't know precisely what they might do, but there's a danger in all of this, even if it's only posturing, that there's a mistake, an accident. Don't forget, in 2001, a Chinese aircraft shadowing an American reconnaissance plane clipped that plane. The Chinese plane crashed. The pilot died. The American plane had to make an emergency landing, and over 20 American service personnel were detained in China in a crisis situation for several weeks until it got sorted out. So that it could potentially get messy.
Mike Shenoy is a non-resident senior fellow at the U.S.-China Institute. He's been speaking to us from Taipei, the Taiwanese capital. Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Sri Lanka is struggling with its worst economic crisis in generations. One of the toughest parts of it, a severe fuel shortage. That is hitting just about every aspect of life there, including what people eat. Sri Lanka is an island nation of 22 million, and people there consume a lot of fish. But without diesel and kerosene, fishing boats can't get out to sea. The World's Carolyn Beeler reports from the capital, Colombo.
I'm standing at the Dikawitta Fishing Harbor just outside of Colombo, and there are dozens of 45-foot fishing boats docked here. Usually boats will come here for a couple of weeks, offload their catch, get new supplies and fuel, and head back out again. But now it is taking months to get a full tank of diesel, and there are a lot more boats here than normal. Boat Captain Simon Indica tells me he's typically here for 10 days at most.
But this time, it took us 2.5 months to get the diesel, so it's been a long time since we went out.
Indica talks to me and my colleague Naresh Eliatambi from behind the wheel of his boat, looking every bit the part of captain with his long, bushy black beard.
This is a crew of 7, and their families depend on this income. So sitting at home for 2.5 months, it means there's no income for our families.
Indica can finally head out soon. They'll be at sea for up to 60 days, filling the hold with salmon and other large fish. He's still waiting on more cooking gas, which is also in short supply in Sri Lanka. And for the first time, he says he's nervous about getting robbed.
While we were in port, we had to have one of the crew on guard day and night. We don't want anyone sneaking in here and stealing anything, especially the gas cylinders.
Fishing and related industries employ more than 10% of the population in Sri Lanka. And fish makes up about half of the animal protein in people's diets. In the kitchen of the Gullface Hotel, a colonial-era seaside place in Colombo, Chef Simon Jayawardena says fish is popular with guests, but his staff basically lives on it.
So every day it is there, like 7 days are there available for a meal, at least for lunch or dinner.
Lots of Sri Lankans don't eat beef or pork for religious reasons, he says.
So our protein content is mostly covered with the chicken and fish.
The country's fuel shortages mean it's harder for people like Jayawardena to source fish, and there's less on sale at markets around the country. In the town of Alacorta, just across the city line from Colombo, there are fish stalls lining a street that runs alongside the canal here. There are only about 4 or 5 open today, selling shrimp and squid and flounder that's still flopping on the fish counters. But most of the stalls here are closed. Behind the fish counter, scooping up shrimp into a plastic bag for a customer, Chaminda Jayalath tells me they're only getting about 50% of the fish they used to get.
Even more than the lack of diesel, it's the lack of kerosene, because the small boats, which do go out for the day, they use kerosene oil, and there's no kerosene at all.
Along the sides of the canal across the street from us, there are lines of these small boats turned upside down and looking like they haven't been touched in weeks. Jayalath says because boats can't go out, prices for fish are way up, more than double. Magdalene Rajamani is here buying cuttlefish, prawns, and mackerel to make a curry back home.
Are you buying the same amount of fish? Are you buying less because it's more expensive?
No, less.
How much less?
Less, sometimes take 1 kilo. Now I am taking 500 grams, sometimes 250 grams.
Portions of everything are smaller these days. But Rajamani, a head nurse at a private hospital in Colombo, says she's not going hungry yet, and she hopes this national crisis ends sooner rather than later.
3-4 months, or 6 months, 1 year, we are hoping.
Here in Sri Lanka, many people are finding themselves worse off. Inflation on food prices is up 75% from a year ago. The UN says that more than 5 million people are skipping meals just to get by. Even a country surrounded by the sea is unable to harvest its fish as long as this fuel shortage continues. For the world, I'm Carolyn Beeler in Colombo.
The U.S. Federal Reserve met today and did as expected. It raised interest rates by 0.75%, another attempt to slow down inflation here in the U.S. The move targets the American economy, but the Fed's actions are far-reaching. Joining me now to discuss the global impacts is economist Michael Klein from the Tufts Fletcher School. He's also a founder of EconoFact, a website that explains complex economic topics for the rest of us. Michael, first of the very basics, raising interest rates again the second time in a month by 0.75% today. How significant is that, and why is the Fed doing that?
Well, the Fed is doing this because inflation continues to be a problem, that there are different measures of inflation. There's headline inflation, which was 9.1% in June, but there is also what's called core inflation, which strips out the prices of food and energy, and that was 5.9% in June. It was the third month in a row in which it slowed. So headline inflation reflects things like high gas prices and high food prices, but the core inflation reflects more what's going on in the economy outside of those volatile aspects.
So when the Fed raises interest rates, it has ripple effects across the globe. How does it impact developing nations in Africa or Latin America, for example?
When the Federal Reserve raises interest rates, it tends to cause the dollar to strengthen, to appreciate. In fact, in one way, the dollar appreciation helps other countries because it means other goods are going to be cheaper in the United States, and so there'll be more imports. But in other ways, it hurts other countries. Countries that have borrowed in dollars will find it harder to repay their debts. Interest rates in other countries might be going up as well, both because they're linked to the dollar, but also because other countries are similarly facing inflation, and those central banks are raising interest rates as well.
And to what degree are all these central banks, Michael, kind of watching each other? Are they pretty much working independently and looking at their own regions?
Central banks' mandates have to do with the economic conditions in their own countries, and they really can't watch too much what's going on elsewhere, except for the fact that there are some spillover effects. But because inflation is generalized throughout the world, they're acting in a very similar fashion, though not necessarily coordinated. But it looks like it's coordinated because the problem is common across so many countries and so many regions.
So, Michael, how are you thinking about the future of interest rates over the next few months, the next 2 quarters, especially as the global economy doesn't seem like it's going to right itself anytime soon?
I think if inflation starts to come down, we won't see continued increases in interest rates. But it's a very hard line to walk to try to bring down inflation without creating a recession. And typically that's what's done. And it's especially hard now because the sources of the inflation are not demand side things, which interest rates directly affect, but supply side things like the price of commodities because of the war in Ukraine, the difficulty through supply chain disruptions because of the pandemic and so on. Hopefully, central banks will be able to pull off the trick of lowering inflation without causing their economies to tumble into recession, but it's a very hard trick to pull off.
Economist Michael Klein is with the Tufts Fletcher School. Thank you very much for explaining all this.
You're welcome, Marco. It's nice to speak with you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Democratic Republic of Congo is auctioning off land to oil and gas exploration this week. And we're not just talking about any old land here. Parcels extend into one of the largest old growth rainforests on Earth. parts of Virunga National Park, the world's most important gorilla sanctuary. There are also tracks in wetlands that store a lot of carbon, and if that is released, the consequences could be nothing short of setting the entire planet back in the fight against climate change. Corneille Iwango is a forest ecologist, the 2005 winner of the Goldman Environmental Prize. Corneille joins us from Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Corneille, can you tell us a bit about the Congo Basin? What is special about the environment there?
Yeah, I think the Democratic Republic of Congo has the largest forest in Central Africa. And that forest is very important in terms of biodiversity. Animals that are nowhere in the world, like the lowland gorilla and the mountain gorillas. But it has also the largest Congo River providing water to the Congo Basin in general. And we still have the peatlands. And that's very important in terms of climate change because it stores more than 30 billion tons of carbon. That forest is like the natural best solution for climate change.
Well, just 8 months ago at the Global Climate Summit, the president of the DRC, Felix Tshisekedi, signed a 10-year agreement to protect the rainforest of the DRC. That included $500 million in international funding. What do you think caused this change of plans?
We applaud the decision that the president made to save the forest. The world promised $500 million. I think what makes that change might be it's not coming.
Corneille, you're saying that the $500 million in international funding was promised but has not arrived?
Exactly. We are in a very poor country, no roads, no good schools, no health care, and so on. So facing that pressure, I think the government has to build the economy and to give solution to some problems that are really real one.
I mean, it's a good point you're making. The Democratic Republic of Congo is one of the lowest income countries in the world. So how do you respond to politicians who say they need the oil money to help the Congolese?
It's the government. They are claiming that. But how they are going to use the money? If that money really goes straight forward to build the country, to build the road, build the school, healthcare, and so on, it's going to be beneficial to Congolese. If that money does not serve really the Congolese, it's going to be a big, big, big damage.
In an ideal world, Corneille, what future do you hope to see for the Congo Basin?
Keeping the entire Congo as a museum, it's going to be quite difficult. So I think by better land use planning, we can achieve the protection and conservation goals while also improving livelihood of the entire community.
I'm guessing, Corneille, that ideally you would like Congo's forest to be preserved almost like a museum, but at the same time, your country has to be realistic, yes?
Sure, exactly, exactly, because we have to make a realistic choice.
Corneille Iwango is a forest ecologist. He joined us from Goma in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Thank you very much for being with us, Corneille.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
From American counterculture to the Chinese mainstream, a quintessentially American sport is catching on in China. It's called Feipan in Mandarin, which means literally flying disc. You know it as Ultimate Frisbee. The world's Rebecca Canther took to the field with a club team in Shanghai.
It's a sweltering summer night, and the cicadas are deafening. Here, under the bright lights of a soccer pitch, a group of more than 50 people are chasing after flying plastic discs. Wang Kai and his wife started this frisbee club 2 years ago. COVID travel restrictions have made it harder for people to go anywhere, Wang says. Frisbee is a great way to exercise outdoors and make friends. When they started, the club attracted about 500 people. Now there are 2,000. Wang leads trainings 6 nights a week around town. Tonight, about half of the crew are rookies. One of them is 22-year-old Yoyi Fan. She and a friend are still learning how to throw and catch a disc. I was looking for a team sport, she says. I like basketball and soccer, but they aren't as inclusive. Frisbee welcomes all genders. They're really friendly here. Ultimate is one of the few non-contact, mixed-gender sports in China. That may be one of the reasons why women, especially, are flocking to it now. Amy Yen, Wang Kai's wife and the official photographer for the club, says social media like Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, have helped grow interest in the sport. Before they saw it on social media, most people didn't realize Frisbee was a sport, she says. They thought it was just something to play with your dog. On Xiaohongshu, the Chinese answer to Instagram, searches for Frisbee have jumped 17 times over last year. Posts like this one are popular. Young women in yoga gear play Frisbee and pose for the camera with the tagline, "Put down your phone and pick up a Frisbee." It might be the current hot trend, but ultimate Frisbee has been a thing in China since the early 2000s.
Back then it was, you know, sort of a handful of foreigners getting together in a parking lot to throw a Frisbee.
That's Matt Sheehan, a fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. In the Chinese ultimate Frisbee world, he's known as Ma Te, the host of a series of funny instructional Frisbee videos in Mandarin.
Hey!
Qian says ultimate Frisbee goes over well in China, in part because of the sport's chilled-out social vibe.
It might sound kind of corny, but I have personally seen it radically change a lot of Chinese people's lives. And when they get to college and they encounter Frisbee or as adults, it's just a chance for them to really like express themselves and just live a little bit freer.
That appeals to Chinese parents. At this weekend Frisbee training, 2 6-year-old twin girls are passing a Frisbee back and forth on the field. Their mom, Joy Wu, says she chose Frisbee because the positive spirit of the game appealed to her. It teaches them to keep trying and never give up. Learning Frisbee will help them to be healthy and happy, she says. Soon, more Chinese people may get the chance to learn about ultimate. In April, China's Ministry of Education approved flying disc as part of its physical education curriculum. The government also announced a new national ultimate Frisbee league. For the world, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
A cafe manager in Tokyo developed a trick for writers struggling with procrastination. His place has no music, no noise, and no distractions. The cafe owner even checks in on you to make sure you're staying focused. Coffee served by a taskmaster. If you missed that story on our radio show, then head over to theworld.org, where you can listen to and check out other stories by our reporters across the globe. You're listening to The World. The Gambia in West Africa suffered under a dictatorship for more than 20 years. Then it established a Truth and Reconciliation Commission to confront that past. Perpetrators have come in direct contact with some of their victims.
I'm willing to forgive him if he apologizes meaningfully. Not just verbal, I'm sorry, I regret it, that's all. I need to know him.
Still to come here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. For 22 years, people in the Gambia suffered under a brutal dictatorship. Then in 2018, the West African nation established a Truth, Reconciliation, and Reparations Commission to confront that past. The commission documented hundreds of human rights abuses under the rule of former President Yahya Jammeh. A handful of Jammeh's henchmen have been brought to justice, but Jammeh remains in exile in Equatorial Guinea. There's no way of knowing how soon the former president could face trial. In the meantime, reconciliation back in the Gambia is a painstaking process. Today, part two of our coverage. Reporter Alexa Dvorsen reports on one so-called jungler, a perpetrator who served on Jammeh's death squad, and his effort to make amends.
I'd have to take that again. All three of you killed him.
Yes, Council.
You used to eat at his house.
Yes, Council.
You were friends with him.
Yes, Council.
He helped you.
Yes, Council.
You executed him in cold blood.
Yes, Council.
Help us understand what was...
In July 2019, Omar Amadou Diallo told the Gambian Truth, Reconciliation and Reparations Commission about his role as a hitman for former President Yahya Jammeh. In this exchange, he acknowledged his part in killing his own friend, Haruna Jame, a cousin of the president who opposed the regime.
What did you do with the body?
We took the body to where we, the same well where these Ghanaians were.
Omar Jallo is one of only a few junglers who didn't flee the Gambia 5 years ago when Jame did. He chose to stay put and tell all. After 2.5 years in detention, he waived his right to legal counsel and the right to remain silent when he testified. He explained how he and two other junglers threw Haruna Jame's body in a well where the corpses of dozens of West African migrants had been dumped earlier that year, 2005.
If I don't do it, it will be done to me. Because that was the way the former head of state operates. If you fail to do the orders, what the orders requires is what is put on you.
So you've basically feared for your own life if you didn't obey these orders?
Yes, of course.
I met Omar Jallo earlier this year. It was his first time speaking with a reporter. Oya, as he's known, was involved in the deaths of 48 people. The more sinister nicknames for other junglers, like Hitler and Rambo, fit their gruesome missions. Oya says he's most haunted by his part in the killing of someone from his own ethnic group. The man shared his last name and felt like family.
At the time we were executing him, he told me, "Bro, you are killing me." I told him, "Yes, because that is the order. I'm sorry."
With a gun or something else?
No, we strangled him with a rope.
So was that the method that you used the most often?
Of course, yes, that is the method we use most often.
Cheaper than bullets, I guess.
Yes, cheaper than bullet, and more secretive as well.
Now 50, Oya says he still wants to serve in the army. It's in his blood, as he puts it, but he knows he may end up in prison if he's prosecuted.
If I am to think of reconciliation, I must tell the Gambians the truth, what I did, and I believe everybody knows about that. I did apologize also, but it's now the Gambian people who will either forgive me or else whatever they feel.
One of the Gambia's human rights commissioners is Imam Babali, a religious leader and public figure whose stirring sermons used to get him in a lot of trouble, including torture.
You are talking about women's rights, child rights, freedom of speech. You are talking about total liberation of mankind. And dictators don't want to hear that, obviously.
The imam won't describe what happened to him. It's too painful to recount. He spent the next 5 years in exile when he was sent to the U.S. for treatment.
Those who used to come to torture me, they were surprised that I don't resist. I said, whatever they've done to me, but I didn't change my mind. I was forced to apologize. I said, I will never apologize when I'm right.
I told him about my conversation with one of the junglers and mentioned him by name.
Oye Jallo, that man was one of the people who tortured me all the time. He was one of the team that wanted to kill me. I feel he must be dealt with accordingly. They must bring him to book.
And then?
I'm willing to forgive him if he apologized meaningfully. Not just verbal, I'm sorry, I regret it at all. I don't mind to forgive as a human being, as a Muslim. But there are certain crimes at least they should not get away with. That's what I feel. I need to know him.
A quick call to the Truth Commission's Reconciliation Committee and a meeting between Oya Jallo and the imam was arranged for the following week.
It's 1 o'clock sharp, and I'm sitting in the conference room of the Gambian National Human Rights Commission. This is a very formal occasion. There's a video camera set up. We're sitting at a long conference table, and we're waiting for the imam to come. There's a certain tension in the air, because there's no way of knowing if the imam will actually forgive Oya Jallo for having tortured him.
We welcome you all. We believe that the National Human Rights Commission, being an institution that has been mandated to promote and protect human rights, that this is really the home of reconciliation.
Commission Chair Emmanuel Diouf.
So we welcome you all. And without further ado, I will hand over to you so that we can continue with this session. Thank you very much.
After a speech by another commissioner, the microphone was handed to Oya Jallo, who stood and reached across the table to hand Imam Babali some kola nuts, a traditional gesture of respect. Speaking in Wolof, he apologized to the imam, his family, and all Gambians, saying he'd had no choice but to carry out commands in the army, including torture.
Because man na ma bay jurna ñu nga xamne
I recognize you as an elder with children older than I, he said. Then in the Fula language, he added, please forgive me in the name of Allah and his prophet.
I accept the apology of my brother, my son, Omar Amadou Diallo. And I must thank him and call for all perpetrators to come out and confess. We want to be better than them, and we can only be better than them if we forgive them. I'm expected to be a role model, to encourage reconciliation, because we love our country. We want to get our country back.
Then they shook hands on camera, a momentous step along the country's healing path.
How are you feeling right now, Oya Diallo?
Very pleased, definitely. Because when I think of the day that was happening, and today he can sit and forgive me, I'm very grateful today. I want to go to every victim that I offend to apologize.
I've just arrived at the mosque, and Imam Babali is beckoning me.
The women's section is in an adjacent building where the imam's voice is coming through a loudspeaker. Imam Babali had told me his next sermon at Friday prayers would be about forgiveness and reconciliation. With a hand on his heart, he's fond of saying, this chest is too small to store anger. He later wrote me that he felt a sense of relief after forgiving Oya Diallo and that he's more at peace now than before. Not far from the mosque is the memory house, where director Siran Dao keeps a watchful eye on the ups and downs of transitional justice. As a guardian of all the Truth Commission's transcribed testimonies, she's committed to keeping the facts straight, no matter who's in power.
What we have done is our work, and we get to preserve that. If the government decides one day to erase all the videos, we will have records. We're learning from history around the world. It's a very delicate balancing act. I don't think any single human being has the capacity to really do justice by everybody. We have to do it as a country and say, we are deciding to do this, and we are okay with this, and we will move on.
There's plenty of moving on to do in the Gambia. This song in the Fula language by Dabi Toure is about forgiveness, which for some people here is too much to ask. Others point to social problems that they say need more urgent attention: the lack of jobs, adequate health care, reliable roads and electricity. The huge challenge for this small nation is to rebuild while pursuing justice and reconciliation at the same time. For the world, this is Alexa Divorson, The Gambia.
The far right in Europe is getting more vocal. In Hungary, Prime Minister Viktor Orban gave a speech a few days ago saying he wanted to stop his country from becoming mixed race. In Italy, the next prime minister could be from a party that's been described as post-fascist. And France's Nationalist Party, with its xenophobic bent, has been gaining seats in the legislature there. Hans-Georg Betz is following this. He's a political scientist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland. Hans-Georg, we're seeing a lot of recent gains by nationalist parties, but now it seems there's almost a matter of pride in wearing that nationalist badge. How long has this been a trend?
I mean, I find it kind of funny when people say the rise, because a lot of these parties have been around for at least 40 years. As a matter of fact, what is now called Le Rassemblement National in France is probably the oldest now party in France, and it certainly is an established party. The same thing is true in Italy with the Lega. So this is not something which started, let's say, after 2008, after the financial crisis. And this goes way beyond that into the 1970s, 1980s.
Yeah, so just to put some words to it, what term do you use to describe these political parties?
I refer to them as radical right-wing populist parties, and radical right-wing populism is a kind of combination of populism, which is basically an anti-elite discourse, together with nativism, which is exactly this kind of notion that we should give absolute priority to our people, whoever our people are. And our people are in Italy, for example, for a long time, our people were Northern Italians because the enemy or the adversary was the South. They didn't like them. So it's a fairly complicated kind of picture, I have to say.
Hans-Georg, you spoke about nativism, and national identity does seem to be an important part of the political platforms for leaders on Europe's far right. What exactly is the identity they're claiming to uphold?
In a sense, I mean, one has to understand it is in conjunction with globalization. Globalization has exacerbated the gaps between different parts of countries. You have the metropolitan kind of cities like Paris, London, whatnot, Berlin. And increasingly in rural areas, they feel basically left behind. They feel that nobody cares about them. They have become, it's amazing, and if you read French analysis of what's happening in France, it's constantly this notion of invisible. People have become invisible. There's no dignity, no respect, okay? And so fundamentally then they are looking for identity. I mean, who are we? And ultimately that becomes, we are French. And being French basically means something. You get this kind of backlash against this cosmopolitanism with this kind of affirmation of identity. And identity means, you know, in France being French. In Europe nowadays, it's against Muslims, Judeo-Christian kind of roots of our civilization. The radical populist right has been very good in kind of mobilizing these identitarian tropes.
As for Viktor Orban, he's planning to head to the U.S. next week for the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, in Dallas. It's where Donald Trump and Steve Bannon, among others, were invited to speak. I'm curious to know how the two sides are influencing each other.
I mean, clearly, if you look at the rhetoric Trump did in 2016, it resonates very well with what a lot of these people said. In Europe, there are clearly affinities between the two sides. I mean, absolutely, no doubt about it. And they tend to, you know, you tend to go to the people who kind of, you know, you're in a friendly kind of atmosphere. And clearly, I mean, Viktor Orban, when he comes to Western Europe, this is not a friendly atmosphere for him. So he goes where he is welcomed as the hero.
Hans-Georg Betz is a political scientist at the University of Zurich in Switzerland, speaking with us about the far right in Europe and its increasingly public display of its ideology. Hans-Georg, thank you very much for your time.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure talking to you.
If you were a kid or had kids in the past 40 years, you'll probably recognize this. The iconic Super Mario Brothers tune from Kyoto-based Nintendo has been around since the 1980s. That's when video games were taking off in Japan and quickly growing in popularity across the globe. Now, decades later, some of the oldest games are at risk of being lost forever. But not if one small group in Tokyo has their way. The world's Bianca Hillier explains.
The Game Preservation Society is on a mission.
Our goal is to save the data and the materials that make up Japanese games.
Damian Rogers lives in Osaka. He's one of only two English-speaking members of the nonprofit. Most are Japanese. They all share a deep appreciation for the country's video games.
We believe that video games are more than just toys. They are just as culturally important as movies, as books, as works of art.
Imagine not being able to watch your favorite film from childhood. But that's what's happening with video games. The Game Preservation Society, or GPS, predicts at least 20% of all games made in Japan are already gone. Some have been left to gather dust and erode in basements, while others have been tossed out as new technology has come on the scene. GPS has been doing their part to save the day since 2011, and they're not messing around.
For example, for a cardboard box, we will very carefully heat the glue, take it apart. It will be flattened and stored in archival folders. The games are taken out, professionally cleaned, and then, of course, store that in the archive in Tokyo, which is temperature and humidity controlled.
They also extract the data from the games and back them up on modern media instead of the floppy disks and cassettes from the 70s, 80s, and 90s. This way, dizzying sounds from Japanese classics like Pac-Man, Dig Dug, and All Night Nippon will be saved for decades to come. Damian Rogers says the GPS archive now has nearly 100,000 items. The group sometimes buys games from used shops around Tokyo. They're also in touch with major collectors across Japan. And this project can get pricey.
The market is absolutely insane.
A single game can cost up to a few thousand dollars. But when it comes to curating their archive, GPS isn't always looking for the most popular titles.
Obviously, we enjoy playing games and we want to be able to play games for fun. But it's about how much that game is at risk of being lost forever.
Sometimes the most mundane games are at the highest risk of getting damaged or thrown away. As for the gameplay itself, technology is vastly expanding the virtual worlds in which people play. Rogers says it's important for programmers and researchers to be able to track that progression, and hopes the GPS archive can help with that, all while offering a bit of fun along the way. For The World, I'm Bianca Hillier.
Militias backed by Turkey already control parts of northern Syria. Now, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan wants to deploy more Turkish troops to other parts of Syria. Not only that, Erdogan also wants to resettle potentially a million Syrian refugees currently living in Turkey back inside Syria. The World's Duri Baskaran in Istanbul reports.
I reached Hussein, a Syrian father of two, on WhatsApp outside the Syrian city of Azaz. Out of concern for his safety, we aren't sharing his full name. He tells me he had lived in Turkey since 2012, but back in March, he says he was stopped by plainclothes policemen in Istanbul. They asked to see his ID. Hussein says the ID he presented was a temporary protection ID given to Syrian refugees in Turkey. But he says the police took him to a migrant detention center. I have no criminal cases against me, he tells me in Arabic through an interpreter. After 10 days in detention, Hussein says he and 150 others were put on a bus and sent to Kilis, a city on Turkey's eastern border with Syria. He remembers a fenced area with low prefab containers used in construction areas. People were told to wait outside before being called into the trailer in groups of five, he says. There was a Syrian translator who told us to sign these papers so we could return to Istanbul, Hussein says. But some members of the group spoke Turkish and realized they were being asked to sign a document agreeing to voluntarily return to Syria. Hussein says people who refused to sign got a beating, and word spread quickly down the line. Sign it with your dignity, or you'll be beaten, the officials told him. Then you'll just sign it anyway. So Hussein says he agreed. The group was bussed across the border into a section of Syria under the control of militias backed by Turkey. Hussein has been there ever since. Now, he says, he has no work and no prospects. Most people in this part of Syria are just getting by on humanitarian aid. The security situation is stable now, he says, but it can turn upside down at any moment. The country is controlled by different militias and government forces with sporadic clashes. Hussein says he's worried about a new military incursion by Turkey. People are living just because they're not dead, he says.
Aziz, Jarablus, Elbab.
On May 3rd, in a televised address, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan announced a government plan to resettle up to a million Syrian refugees in parts of Syria under Turkish control. The country has already begun to build 250,000 cinder block homes funded by relief groups. Erdogan says that 500,000 Syrians have already returned voluntarily, but the United Nations estimates the number is closer to 140,000. Sending Syrians back to Syria is a popular idea among Turkish voters. They're growing more and more hostile towards Syrian refugees. In Turkey's capital, Istanbul, police have been stopping people and checking IDs, and officials have acknowledged that thousands of people have been deported in the last 8 months. It's not clear how many of them are Syrians. A government spokesman declined to comment on the cases mentioned in this story. They've been using any excuse, says Nasreen Al-Rash. She's with a group that works with displaced Syrians. Over a Zoom call, she says that even changing your address can get you deported these days. If you return to Syria, Al-Rash says, the Turkish government claims you'll have a house and access to work. But Al-Rash says that's not true. No sane person would voluntarily return to Syria at this point.
I dare to speak because I know that I have done nothing wrong.
Ahmed, aged 33, says he was on his way home from buying groceries when he was stopped by police in Istanbul. He asks not to use his full name because he doesn't want to be reported to Turkish authorities who control Al-Bab, the Syrian city where he lives. Like Hussein, Ahmed says he had legal papers to live in Turkey and had never committed a crime. He says he was also loaded onto a bus, forced to sign papers, and sent across the border.
Some of us refused to sign, so they would sign in on our behalf, and they would take our hand and just press it against the paper, against our will.
Ahmed says his wife and 10-year-old son are still back in Turkey. His family spent years making a life for themselves, and he made decent money as a tailor. But now his wife is struggling just to get by.
My family sold the furniture, and now they are living with the neighbors. Business owners don't allow female workers to work if they have a child.
Ahmed says his best hope at this point is to borrow money to pay off human traffickers to help him cross back into Turkey.
I'm being strangled here. I just hope to return to my wife and son. Like, that's the bottom line.
If he does make it back to Turkey, Ahmed can bring his case to court, but there's no guarantee he'll be allowed to stay. For the world, I'm Derry Biskaran in Istanbul.
I think I have found my spirit animal. She's a 1,300-pound walrus named Freya, who has taken up residence at a fjord in Oslo, Norway. Most walruses stick to the icy waters further north in the Arctic, but Freya prefers the warmer weather. She spends her time in Norway snoozing, snacking, sunbathing, then snoozing some more. A spokesperson for the Norwegian Fisheries Directorate, Nadia Deini, spoke to France 24 about Freya.
She takes her time, and then she'll feel like going out to eat again. That's what walruses do. They eat and rest.
Like I said, spirit animal. When Freya feels like a change of scenery, she'll find a pleasure boat and stretch out on it. Then there are the encounters between Freya and tiny fishing boats. The boat does not do so well. Freya has left a trail of destruction in her wake. She has sunk boats in Denmark, Scotland, the Netherlands, Sweden, and now Norway. Doesn't seem to matter, though. The people love her. She's all over the news in Norway. Freya has also become a TikTok star. Videos of a lumbering walrus set to funny music? What more could you ask for? Well, there is more. One newspaper in Norway, Verdensgang, has set up a live stream on their website. All Freya, all the time. Freya the walrus living her best life. That is all from us today. Take a lesson from Freya. Go where the weather's warm and chill. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, cuckoo ka-choo. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
From PRX.